The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
He's currently the founder and spiritual advisor for the Dharmada Foundation, which is based in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he teaches all over the planet, the U.S., Europe, Asia, everywhere. And he's also a wonderful author. Perhaps some of you have read his books, No Self, No Problem, The Magic of Awareness, Embracing Each Moment, and also, I don't know if many of you know, but Anam Tupten is also a poet, and he's written a beautiful poetry book in this last year called Big Sky. So he teaches from his own wisdom and experience and on the spiritual path, sharing the teachings of the Buddha. So enjoy.
In some tradition, they talk about the importance of space between thoughts. Perhaps you are familiar with it. You all look like wonderful meditators. The space between thoughts. And this is quite addressed in many traditions. And there are also methods you can use to create the space between thoughts, often through concentration. This is not about to completely erase all the mental activities in your mind and trying to enter some kind of samadhi or a meditative state of mind. There's no more thoughts for hours and hours and days. That is not really the point. Usually, unless we are meditators, we don't know how to create a space between thoughts in our mind. And there's always this commotion happening in our mind all the time. Like we're always talking, even though nobody's around us. Usually our mind is talking like almost TV or radio, unless you turn it off. Perhaps you have visited families who leave their TV on all day, even though they're not watching it, and they feel somehow there's this solace, some kind of psychological solace. Sometimes our mind is like that. It's always talking, it's always telling a lot of stories of the past and the future. And also, when mind continues to talk, it creates also emotions like anxiety, fear. I do not mean that we should not feel anxiety and fear. And these are, of course, part of our humanness, the reason why we feel anxiety and fear, but sometimes we are kind of lost too much in these states, like worry, anxiety, fear, judgment. It turned out that most thoughts popping up in our mind, the storylines that our mind tells, are quite actually negative. Oh, something bad is going to happen to me. How about my health? Is my child going to be okay when she grows up? Am I going to get stuck in the traffic? Is dinner going to be delicious tonight? And then sometimes we go back and we revisit the past and we somehow obsessed with the negative, painful memories, this terrible something happened to me, somebody hurt me. Of course, we have to remember, we have to sometimes feel even anger and even indignation to respect ourselves, but sometimes we are very much lost in the anger, grief, resentment in relationship to the past event that may have happened even long time ago. And this is why maybe there is this kind of restlessness and this very subtle form of unhappiness runs in our mind every day. And that's why we can train ourselves to create the space between thoughts. I know it sounds very simple, space between thoughts. It's not very flowery language. It's very simple. But they have developed many methods in the past that help us to create space between thoughts. Sometimes they use the sound, sometimes they use the visualization, and sometimes they also use the art. For example, I was doing this art recently. Let me tell the story. I have a friend, this Tibetan Lama, who is a wonderful calligrapher. And also I'm a calligrapher as well. And I'm a tanka painter, not a professional tanka painter. When I was young, I learned how to do tanka painting, the sacred Tibetan Buddhist art. Not because I want to turn that into my career, but out of curiosity. And then I haven't done any painting or drawing for ages, for last 23 or 4 years. And then my friend said, well, can we do something together, some project? And he said, I'm a good calligrapher, you are a tanka painter, maybe you can do something with our skills for fun. I said, why not? What shall we do? Then we decide to create this beautiful copy of a Heart Sutra. Many of you are familiar with the Heart Sutra, one of most famous Buddhist liturgies. And then he did the calligraphy. I did the drawing. I drew some Buddhist symbols like the conch and the Dharma chakra, will of the Dharma with some fluffy silks. It took long time for me to revive and that forgotten skill in my body. And I actually had to work almost 1.5 days from morning to the evening, which is kind of unbelievable. What I drew was really, really simple, just a few images. In all days, perhaps I was able to do that within a few hours. And this time took 1.5 days. But I remember that was extremely enjoyable to get up early morning and completely concentrate on this drawing. And I was really happy, was meditative. And I felt that I didn't have lots of thoughts for one day. It was really blissful. I was so amazing in the evening when I took a break, and then I had dinner. Even dinner tastes more delicious than ever for some reason. It's all my mind. But I didn't have so much thoughts for a whole day because I had to concentrate on the drawing and the meticulously done. You can't really make too many mistakes. You have to draw lines perfectly with so much concentration. And if you shake your hands a little bit, you can mess up the whole thing. That's why I was there 100%, and I forgot all my problems, which is good news. Didn't a very famous American writer, Mark Twain say, I have many problems in my life, except most of them never happened. So anyway, all my problems are gone, worry, anxiety, all the storylines really didn't happen. And kind of felt I was living another life that has no problems. All the usual problems, concerns are completely gone. And I realized that was like the power of the concentration. Concentration that creates space with your thoughts. But because this is a concentration, I felt very good towards the end of the day. I felt very much rejuvenated and energized, happy, relaxed. I felt some kind of ease in my body as well. So this is showing that how powerful it is when you intention, you create a gap between thoughts. And all of you seems to be really wonderful meditators. Maybe I'm just teaching some kind of ABCD level of meditation. Hope I didn't, I'm not going to disappoint you. Come in here and all you hear is some kind of ABCD level meditation. How to create a space between thoughts. And then traditionally we also use various objects for the concentration, such as sounds. Doesn't have to be even mantra, or you can use a mantra as well. Maybe I should talk about mantra a little bit. Mantra is a quite common practice in both Tantric Buddhism and also Hinduism. Mantras are usually sacred incantations that have a specific meaning. Other times, they have no meaning. There are different ways of chanting the mantra. In my tradition, we chant lots of mantras for different purposes. One of them is to give rise to devotion. Another reason is to really center all your attention, all your energy onto something benevolent, something sacred. We chant in my culture this mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, Namo Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is this Mahayana Buddhist archetype. Sometimes Avalokiteshvara appears as a female, sometimes a male, but that's not the really point. The point is that it is an archetype that symbolizes this all-embracing love, like universal love. So the idea is when you keep reciting that the mantra, sometimes you can concentrate on love, concentrate on the universal love, and that can have amazing impact in terms of changing and transforming your consciousness or your mind. Maybe in modern neuroscience, you may say that has the power to change, modify your neurological structure. So either way, when you chant mantra as a way of centering all your attention on the subject that is benevolent, that has to love, compassion, peace, then it changes your consciousness. But then, that's of course totally another topic, but we can also use mantras, longer mantras, or even simple mantras to concentrate on. Like for example, ah, we use often letter ah, and then we chant the letter ah, and we meditate on the sound of saying ah, and sometimes we also use visualizations as well as also object. Sometimes we put in Tibetan tradition such as a grain, like barley grain, and then you bring all your attention and focusing on that grain, just one grain, barley grain. Or also you can concentrate on any small object in front of you and then continue to concentrate until you feel that all your thoughts and the mental activities subside. And also we use sometimes visualizations. Often we visualize the image of a Buddha, sometimes also deities. And we sometimes visualize the deities really, really thin, so thin as the size of a barley grain. And then you have to really work hard sometimes to visualize the barley size of this deity or Buddha, and then concentrating all the lines. Basic kind of, you have to almost let go of all your thoughts and mental activities and completely bring your entire attention onto that object, and which is a form of concentration, and then you experience the space between thoughts. And then the space between thoughts, sometimes we're able to let go of our thoughts of the past, thoughts of the future, worry, anxiety, judgment. And then when we come out of the space between thoughts, we feel literally our consciousness has been renewed within even sometimes short period of time. We feel that we are indeed living a new life. We are living in a different kind of world. The world that was there maybe 10 minutes ago, world that was kind of troubled, unfriendly, where you had lots of problems. And then suddenly you feel that you are living in a totally new world where everything is more positive, benevolent, and you feel you don't have too many problems that you have to fight in this life. That's how you feel. Your whole experience of your life, yourself, your relationship with reality can be shifted simply by creating the space between thoughts. And the truth is that when you practice concentration, you know how powerful it is, you know how beneficial it is. all your meditators, so you really know how powerful this concentration can be. Like me, I'm a long-time meditator, and I kind of know how to meditate. I hope so. That's why you invited me, right, to talk about how to meditate. But, sometimes people say, I don't know how to meditate. That's not a problem for me. I know how to meditate. So, as meditators, I'm discovering our problem is that we kind of forget to practice what we already learned. It's like exercise. It's like drinking water. We know that drinking water is quite important. We are joking just maybe 10 minutes ago. I have been drinking lots of water, and I told Mira that I'm a camel, I'm ready to walk in the Sahara Desert, and that's why I need lots of water. I have been drinking lots of water. And sometimes we forget the simple things. Like drinking water is so simple thing. We know intellectually how good it is, and we know it helps us not to get dehydrated. I tell you a funny story about dehydration. It's a personal anecdote. almost 15 or 16 years ago, I went back to Tibet and went through this big city in China called Chengdu, very polluted. Recently, I couldn't reach into Tibet, my hometown. And then I was walking a whole day in this giant city, the city of Chengdu, that has millions of people, lots of pollution, and maybe also the climate is a little bit different, and perhaps I was dealing with lots of physical exhaustion, jet lag, and then at one point I felt I was really sick and felt I was dying. I couldn't even walk. And then my friends took me to this hospital in this giant city, and then the doctors even didn't examine me. They just gave me IV. And later I learned that's all they do at that time. When you're sick, they just give you IV. They really don't even examine. That's some kind of standard practice. And they let me lie on bed and gave me this IV and this whole, this bottle full of this liquid, and then gave this injection into my vein, and I can see the medicine was dripping into the vein and going through my body, and then I just fell asleep. When I woke up, everything was perfect. And I saw the Chinese scientists are really amazing. They figured out something that the Western doctors didn't figure out. It turned out perhaps I was dehydrated. And maybe a little bit exhausted. All I needed was a little water and take a break, take a nap, and I was perfectly fine. And this happens sometimes. We know something so well, but we can't forget it. Many of us know how to meditate. That's why, actually, I'm not going to talk about how to meditate. I was kind of passionate for the last 5-6 years. Traveling around and teach people how to meditate, and that seems to be now almost outdated subject, because most people know how to meditate. So I need some new kind of enthusiasm, new passion. Now I can talk, travel around all over the world and tell people how important it is to meditate. And we all know the benefit we gain from practice and meditation. You don't have to sit for hours each day. You can just sit here and there. But we somehow forget how to meditate. And when I did this drawing a few days ago, I felt so good, but also I realized that I have been forgetting something so simple that I know very well, concentration. And then I made this commitment to myself that I will try my best to practice concentration throughout the day and there. Whenever I can sit. I can sit at the airport. I can remind myself while flying. I can maybe pause for a while before I eat. I can maybe pause here and there throughout the day. And to bring my attention to the breath or bodily sensations, or I can visualize the Buddha, or I can chant mantras or sacred verses. I made that commitment. When you live in a monastery, I used to be a monk, I lived in a monastery, it was easy to concentrate and meditate throughout the day because you are in the monastery and you kind of know you're in the monastery basically not for becoming educated or learning science or business or mathematics so you can get a job someday, and there's no really job prospect when you go to monastery. I went to monastery, now I thought I was really crazy that I decided to go to monastery. Because when you go to monastery, you don't have a chance to think about your future, what job you're going to have. And it's kind of risky, very courageous decision to go to a monastery. And I was a monk maybe for more than decades, 12 or 13 years, I even forgot it. But when you live in monastery, that's all you do. You look around, everybody is practicing meditation, concentration, they are often singing, chanting, prayers, sadhanas. It's very easy to concentrate here and there. You can be, of course, lost in your thoughts, but there's so much supporting from outside that constantly remind you to be mindful, to be present, to check your motivation, your thoughts, and to pause and to create a space between thoughts. Just a few days ago, this wonderful Lama from Tibet came. His name is Mkhambo Tsrimu Lodru. Amazing monk. He's perhaps one of the most influential Tibetan Buddhist teachers right now. He's responsible of a monastery called Larung Monastery that trained around 40,000 monks and nuns. It's the largest Buddhist monastery. You may be able to read about it online. So anyway, he went to that monastery. His teacher was called Khambun Jigme Penso, who is the founder of this monastery. When the Khambun Jigme Penso taught, there would be around perhaps 10,000 monk nuns who lived there. And this was already in the 1990s. People told me that Khambun Jigme Penso have this microphone in his room, and that was connected to all these loudspeakers. Loudspeakers were popular in Tibet at that time. In the 1970s, 80s, the communists used loudspeakers to announce their propaganda. In the 90s, then Buddhist teachers started using that. And to share the Buddhist manifest, whatever that is. Everybody wants to have a loudspeaker, right? So they can propagate their doctrines, either communist doctrine or Buddhist doctrine. So anyway, yeah, I grew up listening to some of this communist propaganda. We had all these loudspeakers, and then they talk about that we have to have allegiance to the central government, etc. So anyway, later we used these loudspeakers to teach Buddhism. So anyway, they told me, I haven't been there, they told me that all the monks, 10,000 monks, nuns, get up early morning and they all meditate, they chant their prayers and then go to his teaching. And then they have lunch. And during lunch, they realize that many of them lose their mindfulness, awareness. They start talking, even though they're monks, nuns, they're still human beings. And sometimes they start really gossiping, like bad-mouthing other people, like have argument, interpersonal conflict during the lunch time. Remember, these monks, nuns are human beings still. And they get kind of angry, lost and worried, storylines, just like anybody else. And then Khambun Jigme Penso pick up the loudspeaker and he will recite this one famous line that we say in the monastery. It's, let me chant this in Tibetan. Chujin Darajin Den Zaparaj. It means, may you all remain in accordance with the Dharma and the Vinaya. Dharma means the spiritual path. Vinaya is the monastic training, the monastic discipline. When he said that through the loudspeaker that goes into everywhere, the 10,000 monk nuns pause right there. And everybody stopped talking. Everybody stopped bad-mouthing, gossiping, arguing, criticizing, judging. And there's this pause, this kind of sacred silence, the space between thoughts. It's so powerful that people feel that there's this kind of silence, almost like a, how do you say, almost like deafening silence. It goes everywhere. And then everybody regains their awareness, their mindfulness, and then they start talking again, but at that time they have much more mindfulness, awareness, knowing what they're doing, knowing what they're supposed to be doing, and then they tend to continue the lunch, engage with each other, have a conversation from more awareness, more mindfulness, not out of unawareness. And this is an example that sometimes you have an environment in the East, like monasteries, temples, where the environment and the people around you constantly remind you to practice the concentration. Recently somebody told me that mindfulness is not enough. You have to practice something like mindfulness of mindfulness. That's a very interesting concept. Perhaps mindfulness is very, very popular. How many of you practice mindfulness? Can you raise your hands? That's good. How many of you ever heard mindfulness? Don't shy, please raise your hands. Oh, you haven't heard mindfulness? How many of you have heard the word mindfulness? Oh, that's quite interesting. So, now I have something to talk about, mindfulness. This can take a whole night. So maybe I should not start talking about mindfulness. So anyway. But the truth is that we are not living in a monastery, and we are not surrounded by monks and nuns all the time, which is not so necessary either. We are lay people, like ordinary people. That's okay. It's okay to be ordinary. You don't have to be monk or nun to be spiritual or to practice meditation. You even don't have to be spiritual to practice meditation. The concepts of being spiritual sometimes have lots of interesting concepts, ideas. You really don't have to be anybody in order to practice meditation. Perhaps I told you this funny story. Some of you have heard many people want to be spiritual. That's very understandable, because to be spiritual means that we are now holy, we are wholesome, we are benevolent. Who doesn't want to be that? So lots of people want to be spiritual, and many people want to have also spiritual names. One time I used to offer people a refuge vow, which is a Buddhist ordination, to start the path, and then I used to write Dharma names, give Dharma names, like Buddhist names, in a very beautiful calligraphy with my stamp. And then everybody loved it. Many people took refuge vow because they get this nice name and beautiful calligraphy. And then later I ran out of the names. Then when people asked me to give them Dharma names or Buddhist names, one time I wrote on the napkin instead of beautiful calligraphy paper and said, "Average Jews." Average Jews. You know, you have this slang, "Average Jews." Yeah, I gave "Average Jews," "Average Jones." And then one woman received a Buddhist name from me. Her name is Average John, again, like Average Joe. But this was written on the napkin. And she told me that's all she needed. She said, "I took that name seriously, and I have placed that napkin on my altar with the Buddha statues and bodhisattvas, and I always met that in front of that napkin, which with the name, the Average John." So The point is that you don't have to be spiritual to meditate. You don't have to be monk or renunciate or yogi. But we live in such an ordinary society. Society is not a contemplative, regardless of which society you live in. Even Tibetan society is not contemplative. There is a kind of collective imagination in the world that the Tibet is this spiritual country, this really enlightened culture. Before Tibet, maybe they thought that India was the spiritual culture. In the West, at least you have had this collective imagination, collective, even the fantasy that India is some holy country, everybody meditates, and then people discover that not true, and then they redirect that whole imagination to Tibet. And for a long time, maybe until late 1990s, that's what people thought in the West. They projected this fantasy, this really wonderful fantasy on my culture, which is kind of nice for us as a Tibetan person. Yeah, it's kind of nice to see that there's a whole world thinking that our culture is a spiritual culture, our people meditate, but that is not the truth. There are not so many contemplative society where everybody meditates, or most people meditates. Even in Tibet, most people really don't meditate. Very few people meditate. Not even every monk meditates. Can you believe it? Very few monks actually meditate. Many monks study and they go around and they do ritual ceremonies for everybody, but not too many of them meditated. This is basically telling us that so far, unless there's going to be a big change happened, there hasn't really been in human history, whole society, whole culture is contemplative, where everybody meditates, where every children have to go to elementary school, and first thing they learn is meditate. Every politician had to meditate before they are elected. That never happened, right? It would be nice. Maybe one of the prerequisites to become politician is that you had to meditate for 10 years, and then you can be and then you can allow to whatever, run office or to be a political candidate, try to elected as a mayor of your town, then maybe governor, then maybe the president of the country. Wouldn't that be amazing? But this is not happening. The only society that became enlightened was this kind of legendary kingdom. It exists in some Buddhist literatures. It could be some kind of mystical land, or could be some land in India called Odiana land, where everybody become enlightened, so whole the kingdom become empty. But you know, that could be some kind of mystical dimension that even we didn't have access to it. But other than that, unless I'm ignorant of the human history, I never really discovered that there's one whole nation, whole society where, let's say, the even 60%, let's say even the 50% people truly meditate. This is reflected by a very famous Buddhist parable. Once upon a time, a powerful king lived, and he had this oracle with whom he always consulted. This oracle was a kind of all-knower. Oracle, right? Oracle? Oracle?
Oracle.
And she can predict everything, all the unseen future event. One time, as usual, the king went to the oracle and said, "Tell me, what is going to happen to the world? What is going to happen to my kingdom?" The oracle said, "Well, bad news. There's going to be rain, very heavy rain within 1 week. The rain is toxic. And the rain is going to pollute all the rivers, lakes, wells, ponds, all the water exists in the kingdom. And then once all the waters are poisoned, whoever drinks the water, they are going to be crazy. They're all going to lose their sanity. They're all going to be crazy. And then King come back with such anxiety, and then he really worried about this situation, this event that is going to happen. And then he, of course, was so terrified by the prospect that everybody in his kingdom is going to be crazy. And he want to save people, he want to warn people, but he realized that there's no way he can actually prevent people from drinking the water. So he decided to hide the news. But he didn't want to become crazy, so he actually built some kind of pagoda or some kind of big umbrella on the royal well, so he can have access to this pristine water. And then, as the oracle predicted, within 1 week, heavy rain came. It rained day and night. And then nobody knew that it was poisonous. Everybody went to the river, pick up water as usual. Then everybody became crazy suddenly, the whole kingdom, except him, because he knew the situation and he had access to this pristine water. And he was the only person who wasn't crazy. His queen, his son, daughters, the princes, the prince, his ministers, his subjects, they all become crazy. He's the only person who is not crazy in the entire kingdom. But as time went by, everybody knows their king is acting a little bit strange. And he thinks a little bit strangely, and he talks very strangely. Somehow they start realizing that he is changing, not for the better, but for the worse. And finally they are pretty much sure that their king is actually losing his basic sanity. Somehow this king is becoming more and more crazy. And there was a huge conference finally. All the ministers, the queen, everybody came together, and they said, "Our Lord is no longer sin. He does not fit to be king, so we must choose another person, one of his sons, to be the new king. We should dethrone him." And then they send this message to the king about that he's going to be dethroned, and someone else is going to be the king, and then he had chance to make choice whether he's going to remain the king or to keep his sanity. So he realized that to be sane is really wonderful, not to be crazy, but then he realized that to be king is more tempting, because he can be the king, he can have best food, he can wear beautiful clothes. You see, he can get everything, all the worldly glories. He will be worshipped, he will be loved. So his ego realized that it's much more beneficial and to lose the wisdom, to lose the sanity. And so he can keep all the glories in the world. Fame, wealth, security, certainty. And then he rushed to the river and drank water and became crazy. And then everybody realized that their king regained his sanity and he continued to be king. Everybody was happy. This is a happy ending story. So this parable is something we always share in the Buddhist teachings. And we share this parable really to point out that as a society, as a culture, there is indeed poverty, spiritual poverty, spiritual poverty, and that we don't have enough wisdom, we don't have enough contemplation. And for example, tonight maybe we have around 100 people, but if you think of the population of the whole world, or even this country, this is such an insignificant number. If you think of this city, Minneapolis, you represent a very small portion of the city's population. It is true that many people go to Buddhist temple, they pray, they chant, but that does not mean people practice and contemplation. I have been visiting Asia within the last 3 or 4 years to teach. I went to Malaysia, I went to Hong Kong, South Korea, and especially when I go to Asia around the Chinese New Year, the temple is so busy. These temples are extremely busy. And one time I visited this beautiful Kuan Yin statue in Malaysia. This is a huge statue of Kuan Yin, big as a high rise, perhaps cost millions and millions of dollars to build it. And personally, I love Kuan Yin, the image of Kuan Yin. So I went there and I had a little conversation with my Chinese friends, and they are kind of my students, some or other. I kind of asked them, and what do people do? Because so many people are coming, they are burning incense, bowing. And basically they informed me that most people come there to pray for longevity, success, for children, but especially if not just children, but to have a son. And they pray for a son over a daughter. So it was kind of disheartening for me to hear that. That's what people do when they go to temples. And then I said, let's pray together. And we all sat together. We did prayer, but we recited this Bodhisattva's verses composed by Chandin. They were 7th century Indian Bodhisattva mystic. It's a beautiful verse which is used as way of holding the Bodhisattva's vow. So we chanted that. We hold again the Bodhisattva's vow, the vow of spiritual heroine, the vow to remain in the world, to practice love, compassion towards all beings, and felt quite good. So what I'm trying to say is that even people in the temples, even people are chanting prayers, do not necessarily practice contemplation and reflection. That's why, except some monasteries, we don't really have a contemplative culture. That's why it's so easy to be distracted with our mind, with our thoughts, so easy to be lost in unawareness, even though we know how to meditate. And now they have these devices, as you know, on your smartphone, you can download all kind of apps. And first of all, they're very critical. I thought this is another business. This is not okay. Especially when they have apps that remind you meditate. But now I'm actually kind of endorsing it. Remind you, I'm not hired by that company as a spokesman for their product. Let me be clear, I'm not hired by them. So anyway, I actually first really skeptical about kind of any kind of this mass production of anything, especially spiritual practices. But now I like it. One time a friend of mine gave me a ride from my home to San Francisco Airport, and we were driving on the Bay Bridge, and then I heard this noise thing. He said, this is a some app. It means I have to pause for a while driving car. and then it was so good, then I had to pause too for a while. I felt kind of good. Just immediately that sound put both us back into awareness. Okay, we're not supposed to be gossiping, all right. Like that. So after that, I changed my mind towards this product. You know, why not? We are buying Coca-Colas anywhere, right? Coca-Cola, all this product. Why not? We can't buy all this app this app that reminds you how to measure charge. I think this product has more benefit than Coca-Cola, don't you think? So we can't help to encourage each other to meditate in a barrier which I consider the world capital of bumper stickers. Do you have affinity with the bumper stickers? I do have. When I go somewhere in the world, I always look first and say, are there any bumper stickers on the highway? When I go to Asia, there are no bumper stickers. Then I get a little bit of, how do you say, grouchy. Can I say that? I love bumper stickers somehow. And bumper stickers symbolize something to me, some kind of freedom of expression, and evolution symbolize a little bit of a high level of consciousness. So in the Bay Area, I'm not sure about Minneapolis, but when you drive, you can always look around and really observe all these bumper stickers. Some of them are very creative, some of them are funny, some of them are not so good. And my favorite bumper sticker is got bodhicitta. You know, like got milk, got bodhicitta. And that was really brilliant bumper sticker. Got bodhicitta. Bodhicitta means awakened heart. Got awakened heart. It's like some people really wanted to encourage people to consume the meditation, consume the bodhicitta. And they are kind of encouraging everybody to get into the practice, the spiritual practice, whatever you like, of mindfulness, and meditation, concentration, loving kindness. So at least some people have the intention to create a contemplative culture. Enlightened culture is maybe too much, maybe too lofty idea. So let's forget this idea of a creative enlightened culture, but maybe we can little by little contemplative culture. And so we can help each other, we can help everybody to be more introspective and help each other to remember how important it is to practice meditation here and throughout the day for our own well-being, for our own happiness, as well as the happiness and the inner peace of everybody around us. So basically, the way we can turn ourselves as a meditator or yogi, by the way, it's really good to have identity. The common ground, which is in many ways connected with the inside society, is that okay? Is that politically correct to say? I'm just joking. Right? The common ground is very much connected with the inside meditation society. I'm very, very in good friendship with these teachers of inside meditation society, like Jack Kornfield, amazing teacher, and met with Sharon Salzberg recently. We had a chance to share some time together. When Shunryu Suzuki Roshi came to United States, he was very amazed by the American meditators, by their wisdom, by their dedication, and he said, I don't know what should I call you. You're not monks, nuns, but you're not lay people either. Because in Asia, only monks, nuns, with the shaved head, either orange robes or gray color robes, meditate. Lay people don't meditate. They just come to temple, bring incense, or offer food and dana to the monks. And then they think they are accumulating merit. That's all they need to do. He was very amazed by the level of dedication, the wisdom, the intelligence being demonstrated by his Western students. So he said, I don't know, what should I call you? At Spirit Rock, for example, one of the main centers within Insight Meditation Society, they call everybody yogis. And that's really wonderful identity, yogis. Yogi, let's go back to the word yoga. Yoga is a very big concept word, and both Hinduism and also Tantric Buddhism. In Tibetan, yoga is called Nanjur. Almost you can use the term yoga to every spiritual practice. For example, Tibetan Buddhism, we have many yogas like Dream Yoga, Guru Yoga, Maha Yoga, Anu Yoga, Adu Yoga, Kriya Yoga, Upa Yoga, etc. There are many yogas. In Tibetan, Namjul means actualization. A terminology of Namjul means actualization, you are understanding something, not just through intellect, but by your own heart, your own direct experience. So, the one who practices yoga is a yogi or yogini. So in that sense, meditation is a form of yoga, mindfulness is a yoga, awareness is a yoga. Of course, in the modern world, when you say yoga, people think the hatha yoga. That hatha yoga that everybody is doing. Recently, I was in Germany. They said, we are going to choose a topic for your next year's retreat in Bremen, but can we call it heart yoga? And then somebody, that sounds some kind of cardiovascular training or something like that. And then we said, oh, that doesn't work. Maybe we can call it yoga of the heart. But it has nothing to do with the hatha yoga. It has to do with, of course, meditating on love, compassion, how to open one's heart. So anyway, we are yogis. I think it's very nice to identify yourself as a yogi or yogini, which means the same thing. And we need more yogis and yoginis in this world. You don't have to be monastic in order to be yogi. You are yogi, you are yoginis. We have to create a yoga community. And this is already, to me, yoga community. Community to practice yoga, the true yoga, yoga of awareness, yoga of love, yoga of compassion. And also the way to become yogi is to hold some kind of vow. We need a vow, we need a sacred vow. Vows are very important. Buddhism is full of vows. And in modern days, even in contemporary spiritual practices, sometimes maybe we don't talk enough about the power of a vow, power of a commitment. Some people are a little bit afraid of even the term vow, commitment. And this has nothing to do with religiosity. Taking a vow is methods to change your consciousness. I strongly encourage everybody to get up every morning and to hold the vow. Maybe first thing in the morning we wake up is to hold the sacred vow. Before you have a chance to rush to the kitchen to have your favorite coffee, or before you have a chance to brush your teeth, before you have a chance to check your emails, maybe when you wake up, the first thing you can do is to hold the commitment, the vow. You can say in silence, I'm going to practice concentration today. I'm going to practice awareness. I'm going to practice mindfulness or meditation throughout the day. And then that hold and vow already created a wonderful ground for your day, rest of your day. And then most probably that commitment will stay in your consciousness throughout the day, and it will remind you here and there, like the sound of the bell in monasteries, or like the sound of Kampon Jigmelpens, or announcing through a loudspeaker, and that will remind you here and there to concentrate on the breath, even for 1 minute, or bodily sensations, or on mantra visualization, and drop into your heart, into your body, and let go of your thoughts of past and future, and refresh your mind once again, and then you can come out, and then you can continue whatever you're doing from mind that is now clear, heart that is open. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for your receptivity.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.